Hey, everybody. Welcome back to All Crime, No Cattle. We're here with another episode for you this week. I, myself, am Shea Butter, Detective Shaw, Dort Nowitzki, and next to me, I've got my wonderful co-host. Introduce yourself.
I'm Aaron. I don't have any cool nicknames.
I think you're DA Aaron.
All right. Oh, I'll take it.
Yeah. Well, what are we doing today, Aaron? We got a lot going on. It's going to be a busy episode.
It is, actually. Well, first up, we have two little announcements. The first thing we'd like to announce is the winners of the raffle benefiting Texas EquiSearch. We've been touting this fundraiser for a while now, and the winners were just picked a couple of weeks ago. So, Shay, would you like to do the honors? Drum roll, please. Big congratulations to Jordan for winning the small raffle of ACNC merch, and to Megan DeGroat for winning the big raffle.
Yay!
We'll be getting our merch out to you both tomorrow, hopefully. And a huge thank you to everyone who donated and all the podcasts who participated in the giveaway. Together, we were able to raise over $850 for Texas EquiSearch. It was a big success. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, it was awesome. I think we did a really good job for our first fundraiser.
I think so, too. And that segues very nicely to our next announcement, which is another fundraiser we're participating in that's being headed by our dear friend Lainey from True Crime Fan Club. And this is for a cause that's incredibly close to our hearts. It's to raise money to erect billboards around Tarrant County asking for information on the 2016 disappearance of Tiffany Johnson. Her missing persons case is also related to the 2006 disappearance of another woman named Taliba Islam. If you don't know much about this case, we will be posting some information about it to social media, so check that out. But this is a fantastic cause. I'm so happy to be a part of it because I've followed this case for years. It's in our area. It's our community. So all you have to do is go to the GoFundMe page. We'll be linking everywhere. Donate $30 or more and send a screenshot of your donation to tcfcpod@gmail.com. That will get you entered to win a backpack crammed full of merchandise from us, True Crime Fan Club, Gone Cold, Disgraceland, Generation Y, Court Junkie, and tons of other podcasts. This is running until October 1st, and winners will be chosen and announced on the 2nd. And again, I can't tell you guys how much this fundraiser means to me personally and to us. As a podcast, we're so excited to be a part of it and getting Tiffany and Taliba's stories out there.
Yeah, it's a really important cause. You and I have both gone out and volunteered with some of the foot searches.
Mm-hmm.
If you have time and not money, that's a great way to go help.
Well, Shay, are you ready to start this week's case?
I'm ready. Let's get back in the saddle.
Well, this episode is a sad one. And we've said this before. Obviously, they're all sad, but there is something so heartbreaking about this case. It's almost like a Shakespearean tragedy. It's bleak. It's such a waste. It's really one of those cases when you research that gets to you that, you know, you almost have to like hold back tears while you're reading the information because it's just a really, really sad case. And I'm sure you'll see why as we get into the details. This is another instance of kind of piecing together a lot of disparate information from several different sources. So our sources are The Independent, CNN, Dallas News, NBCDFW.com, KERA, The LA Times, WFAA, and court documents. A lot of court documents. In fact, almost every single piece of paper generated in this case, I pored over to try to get these details correct. It was grueling, but hopefully it was worth it.
Yeah, I got to see your secondhand losing your mind over court documents for a couple of evenings.
It was a little frustrating, but again, hopefully it was worth it. That being said, after going over all of those pieces of paper, all of this information, I still have questions about certain details. As Shay and I were kind of talking about what we were going to do for our brand new Patreon that we just launched, you can find it at patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. We decided that this would actually be a really excellent case to get into those details and to bring up some things that I can't get to in the episode, some questions that I have, some lingering kind of issues. I think it's going to be really interesting because there's a lot there that rubs me the wrong way and I can't get to it all. So I think it's going to be a really interesting special mini episode. It's going to be our first Patreon episode, and that will come out at the end of October.
Yeah, and this is something we were thinking this might be fun to do in the future with other episodes that we want to go back and rehash over some of the theories and some of the things that are just our own opinions and our own ruminations about things and bring up some maybe unsubstantiated evidence in cases that we left out.
Yeah, hopefully you know by now that we really like to focus on facts. And the wild speculation is not stuff that we like to get into because I think it's ultimately often detrimental to cases. But there's speculation there. Not so much speculation in this case. It's mostly just questions that I have about what really happened this night.
Yeah, sometimes it's fun to go down the rabbit hole.
This story begins not in Texas, but in Iraq, with a man named Ahmed Al-Jumaili. Ahmed lived in Baghdad. According to an article from The Independent, he was a friendly, happy guy who was nicknamed Ever-Smiling Ahmed. He survived three wars and even served as an interpreter for the U.S. Air Force, according to WFAA ABC News. He liked soccer and puzzles and board games and was described as quiet but with a good sense of humor. In 2013, Ahmed married the love of his life, Zahra Atiyi. Ahmed called the day they wed the happiest day of his life.
Aww.
But things weren't easy for the newlywed couple. Around this time, ISIS had taken a stronghold in eastern Syria and had begun a series of militant offensives into northern Iraq, taking cities, executing both soldiers and civilians, and leaving destruction in their wake. And as ISIS continued their steady march, the army of militants were heading south straight for Baghdad. As ISIS began taking city after city in Iraq, especially going into 2014, civilians began to flee south and to seek refuge in other countries. Zahra, her father, and her brother were granted humanitarian refugee status by the U.S., which meant that her family was able to flee Iraq and ISIS and move to the United States. But that also meant that just months after marrying Ahmed, Zahra would have to leave her new husband and travel halfway around the world with her family to live in Dallas, Texas. Meanwhile, Ahmed also applied for refugee status and spent his time working and saving up money for his new life with Zahra in the United States. He worked installing internet connections to households in Baghdad. According to friends, he talked nonstop about his excitement about coming to America and living the American dream with Zahra. He told his friends, quote, "I don't want to die alone in Iraq. I want to be with my wife in America." They hoped to get their own place and to start a family together, safe from the ravages of war.
Sure.
And finally, on February 6, 2015, Zahra and Ahmed were finally reunited after over a year apart. At the airport, Zahra was waiting for Ahmed with balloons, roses, and a sign that said, "I've waited 460 days, 11,040 hours, 662,400 minutes for this moment. Welcome home."
Wow, that's so cute.
It's adorable. Man. And I have this picture of Zahra, and we will be sure to be posting this to our social media so you can see it. It's very sweet.
Man, I know you and I have spent, like, what, a month or so apart?
2 months was the longest.
The longest, and it was excruciating.
Not for me, because I was having fun in South Africa at the
time. Yeah, you were having a great time, but I was here taking care of the house and the dogs and everything, and I'm just missing you the whole time.
Yeah, and can you imagine being away from your loved one for over a year?
No.
While you're in a city watching ISIS coming towards you.
Yeah, that's terrifying. Yeah,
absolutely. Ahmed moved in with Zahra's family temporarily while he and Zahra searched for their own place. The apartment they shared was the Walnut Bend Apartments in far north Dallas. This is very north Dallas. It's almost towards Richardson.
Okay.
As some of you may know, Texas has led the nation in the number of refugees they've accepted. And the city of Dallas has a very high number of Iraqi refugees. This is often a good location for them, according to the LA Times. Since the climate is similar to Iraq with hot summers and mild winters, the cost of living is relatively low, and the job market is better than in a lot of big cities. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes sense. But this is still really difficult to be a refugee. And as far as the federal or state agencies are concerned, it's like, okay, cool, welcome to the country. Goodbye, and they're almost kind of left to their own devices. So a lot of refugees have to rely on fellow refugees or immigrants, family members, and especially volunteer groups who deal and work directly with refugees to help them navigate their new lives, find employment, find shelter, all of that
and
stuff.
A lot of times it's just like finding a vacuum cleaner and learning how to use it and like small stuff like
Or, getting you know, pots needing and pans. Sofa. Yeah, yeah, pots and pans. And, you know, just basic necessities.
Yeah, and figuring out, like you said, how to navigate around and how to do stuff. We were introduced to a couple of really cool organizations that help refugees out. And we've been wanting to volunteer some time and do that kind of thing because it sounds really rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ahmed and Zahra, they knew that life was not going to be perfect, but it was going to be so much better than what they left behind in Iraq. They were going to have so many more opportunities here. They were going to be safer, and that's kind of the number one thing. Within days of arriving in Dallas, Ahmed had purchased a car, and he was already searching for jobs. Again, they were thrilled to be together. They were excited to be finally able to live their lives together. They really felt like they were going to be successful in Dallas and hoped to start a family of their own soon. Then on the evening of March 4th, 2015, a very strange thing happened. It snowed. 3.5 inches to be exact over the course of March 4th and into the early morning of March 5th. Now, that's probably laughable to a lot of people out there living in the very north or very south of the world. I get it. I grew up in Alaska, so I know that 3.5 inches of snow is absolutely nothing. But 3.5 inches is quite a lot for Texas. And in fact, this was the heaviest snowfall in 5 years and one of the largest snowstorms ever recorded in the month of March in the DFW area. So this is very atypical.
Now, you said this was actual snowfall. So it's not like that horrible sleet, freezing rain.
It was actual ice. Real snow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes we get that. We rarely get snow, like actual snow.
Exactly. Usually when it's like, oh, it's going to snow, it's really sleet and or it's something that immediately it falls to the ground and immediately melts. So this was, again, very special. And I bet anyone and everyone in this area, including you and I don't specifically remember this, but I'm sure that you and I were also outside frolicking around in this very uncommon winter wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ahmed and Zahra were no different. Coming from Iraq, Ahmed had never seen snow before, so these two are elated. They, along with Zahra's brother, head outside their apartment shortly after 11 p.m. and start doing what everyone in Texas does when it snows a little, taking pictures and video of the freshly fallen snow. You become like a big kid, especially if you've never seen snow before. Do you think how exciting that is as an adult person, and this is the first time you've ever seen snow?
Yeah, it is a big deal.
At this point, they are standing just outside their apartment building, kind of standing between the building and the parking lot. Seconds after Zahra ends a video of the snowfall, she hears loud noises cutting through the still night air. Her first thought was that someone was setting off firecrackers in the parking lot. Ahmed and Zahra's brother duck behind a truck as the pops continue. Then suddenly Ahmed screams out, "I'm hit," and Zahra sees blood coming from his chest. Ahmed staggers back to the landing, and Zahra and her brother scream for help as they help Ahmed back into the apartment before he collapses on the floor of their living room. Zahra and her brother desperately try to staunch the blood flowing from Ahmed's chest. Emergency responders get to the scene and rush Ahmed to Texas Presbyterian Hospital. But his wound was too serious, and he had lost too much blood. Ahmed Al-Jumaili, who fled his homeland to avoid violence and terror, died within hours from a single gunshot wound to the chest. He was 36 years old. He had been in the United States for less than 1 month.
Oh, man. Dude, that's heartbreaking.
It's so tragic. And that's what I was saying about, like, this almost the Shakespearean tragedy of that. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it's your worst fear, too, because I don't know where you're listening to this podcast from, but here in the Metroplex, hey, a lot of people, there's a lot of guns. You hear gunshots pretty often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's always a big fear of mine is like when you hear a firecracker or something loud, some bang is like, is that a gun? Are they shooting at me in the dark? You kind of freak out a minute.
Yeah.
And this is your worst nightmare come to life.
Yeah, exactly. It absolutely is. After news of Ahmed's death spread, questions started emerging about what happened that night. Was this a random act of violence? Or was Ahmed the victim of a hate crime? Was he somehow targeted because of his nationality or his faith? And this relates very strongly to what was happening a few years ago, and certainly continues to this day, with a lot of anti-Islamic sentiment in the country. Ahmed's murder occurred less than a month after the Chapel Hill murders in North Carolina, when three young Muslims named Diyashadi Barakat, Yusur Muhammad Abu Salah, and Razan Muhammad Abu Salah all between the ages of 19 and 23 years old, were shot to death by a neighbor. That case made international news and stoked debate over whether the three young people were murdered over a simple parking space dispute, or whether their race or faith played a role in the killer's hatred and motivation to kill. Now, the alleged murderer in the Chapel Hill case turned himself in the day of the murders and is still awaiting trial, so we don't really know how all of that is going to play out in the court system. But in 2015, that was still very much at the forefront of everyone's minds. But there were other current events closer to home that stoked people's fears as well. Back in January of 2015, a rally in Austin for the Texas Capitol Muslim Day was interrupted by protesters who carried signs that said things like, "Save America, Stop Islam," and "Radical Islam is the new Nazi," while chanting things like, "Remember 9/11.
Yeah, I remember that.
Then, of course, just 2 days before Ahmed's death, there was the event in Garland, Texas, where two shooters, possibly inspired by or connected to ISIS, tried to ambush an event featuring cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Now, thankfully, both gunmen were taken down before they could hurt anyone, but to a lot of people, this strengthened biases against Islam and against Muslim Americans. So, I mean, there's fear on all sides, and clearly it's terrifying and even bizarre to a lot of Muslim Americans, especially refugees from Jordan, Syria, Iraq, who are like, "We fled to America to get away from ISIS. We hate ISIS more than you possibly can know. They destroyed our lives."
Yeah. And I know a couple of times Sikh temples have been attacked, and they're
by people thinking that they're Muslims.
Yeah. And they're like, "We're a completely different people, ethnic group, religion. Like, we have nothing to do with what your hate is pointed at, but also don't do a hate crime."
Exactly. It's not good, whatever your motivation is.
No.
Don't do it. So this was the current culture at the time of Ahmed's death. And I think that it's interesting how true crime relates to current events and how people see crime through the lens of things like politics, religion, etc. I mean, we saw this just recently with the Molly Tibbetts case. So to get back to Ahmed's murder, was he targeted as a result of some anti-refugee or anti-Islam sentiment? And if he was it because someone had met him and knew what he was and where he was from? Or did someone just see this group of three individuals out late at night, see Zahra who wore a hijab, and decide to attack them right there and then? Mm-hmm. And of course, the last option is that Ahmed was just at the wrong place at the wrong time and that his death was totally at random. Well, fearing that Ahmed's death was a hate crime, the Council of American Islamic Relations became involved in this case. The executive director of the DFW chapter, Alia Salem, said to CNN that their group felt, quote, "extreme heartache and no shortage of sadness for this beautiful young man who had just come to this country." The council offered their own award for information relating to the arrest of the killer or killers. They launched a fundraising campaign for Ahmed's family and helped speak to media outlets to get attention drawn to Ahmed's case. They did a really great job stepping up for this family, being there for press conferences and to talk to the media, and I'm sure being there for emotional support as well. And it makes you really wish that every family member of a murder victim or a missing persons case could have a group like this.
Oh, yeah.
Getting word out there and advocating for them. It would be just a different world if we had that.
So supportive and awesome. And I'm sure that they really appreciated that.
They did, for sure. Yeah. So we spoke about how on the night of Ahmed's death, there was a bit of a snowstorm, at least for Texas standards. And that actually affected the case in a lot of ways. If you live in Texas or in the South in general, you know that when it gets below freezing and it's been precipitating, roads and highways become a disaster zone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just basically, if you can avoid driving, do so. Because you don't want to get into all that.
Nobody down here knows how to drive in winter weather because it never happens. So when it does, people lose their minds.
Exactly. And we also don't have the infrastructure to do major clearings of ice or snow or salting the roads. None of our cars have snow tires, etc. Yep. Like, so it can just get crazy out there when the weather gets bad. So this meant that it actually took hours for detectives and crime scene investigators to get to the scene because the roads were so precarious at the time. So that's kind of one issue. Then by the time they did get there, a lot of the scene had been covered by new snowfall. So the blood evidence and even the shell casings were very difficult to find and photograph. Mm. And in fact, some of the shell casings weren't even found until later by apartment groundskeepers after the snow had melted.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's an interesting part of the crime scene investigation that down here we rarely think about. Because we don't have to worry about how ice and snow and those things affect a scene generally. So these are problems that are unique in this area. In total, 15 shell casings were recovered at the scene of the crime. Investigators found that the area around which Ahmed, Zahra, and her brother had been standing to watch the snowfall was sprayed with bullet holes. Two vehicles in front of them were riddled with bullets, including the truck that Ahmed and his brother-in-law had ducked behind. It was one of these bullets that had pierced the tailgate of the truck and ended up striking Ahmed in the chest.
Oh, man.
Yeah. A nearby fence and dumpster had also been hit by gunfire. So there's a very close spread of rounds around the area where they were standing.
So it definitely looked like they were targeted.
It seems that way, for sure.
That sounds like a lot of rounds.
It was 15 at the very least, because that's how many shell casings they found. The police officers who were first called to the scene spoke to witnesses who said they saw 2 to 4 men enter the apartment complex through a vehicle gate before the shooting and then running away from the scene shortly thereafter.
On foot?
On foot, yes. They were able to find shoe prints in the snow leading away from the crime scene, but once again, these were quickly destroyed by the falling snow. But now that investigators could better trace the possible suspects and the route that they could have taken to make their escape, they were able to track down which of these areas could have security cameras that could have caught them on footage. It just so happened that there was a school nearby that had a security camera, and luckily enough for investigators, this camera captured the suspects as they fled the scene.
Oh, wow. Was it very good?
It's typical security footage, so it's grainy. It's also from a high angle,
dark.
It's in the middle of the night. It's dark. It's grainy. It's from a pretty high vantage point because it's on like the side of the building. So you can't really see their faces or anything. You can just kind of tell that they're male figures, or at least it seems like they're male. That's not even totally clear, right? If it's male or female. Well, we have 4 individuals running along the school building right after the time of the shooting.
Wow, 4.
4. The first male was wearing a bucket hat, also known as a boonie hat. Do you know what this is?
Yeah, it's like a floppy
Like a hat. Military-style hat with a brim.
Like so, you would wear in Vietnam in the jungle, yeah.
Yes, I had to look up pictures. I was like, I have no idea what that is. So he was wearing this bucket hat, and he carried a rifle that was later established to be an AK-47.
Wow.
Yes. The second man followed closely behind to the first, and he held a handgun. The third and fourth men follow a few seconds behind the first two and are not seen carrying weapons. So this is interesting because there are 2 weapons seen in the footage, but it just so happens that the 15 shell casings found at the scene were for 7.62 caliber rounds. All these bullets could be fired from an AK-47. And all of the casings that were analyzed had a dent in the side that indicated they had been fired from an AK-type rifle. They also had identical breech face marks and firing pin impressions, showing that they had all been fired by the same AK-type rifle.
Interesting.
The bullet recovered from Ahmed's chest was a .30 caliber consistent with a 7.62 caliber cartridge fired by an AK-47. So we have 2 guns seen on security footage, but only 1 seems to have been used in the shooting.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, the footage from the school was released to the media in hopes that someone could identify any of the suspects or come out with any information about what happened that night. About a week later, homicide detective Esteban Montenegro received an anonymous tip that the shooter was a man nicknamed, and I'm going to spell this out for you, K-A-C-A. How would you pronounce that?
Caca.
Caca, right? So
Spanish for poop.
I absolutely loved his nickname, literally means shit. And I was so excited to tell you that. Except I watched the press conference late into my research, and that's when I found out that it's actually pronounced Caca.
Caca.
I was very disappointed because that, if you just look at that word, that reads caca.
But and you said Caca. This is what they go by. So this
is their like the nickname? Their like street nickname type
Caca.
Of thing. Caca. Caca. Yes.
Okay.
Detective Montenegro was able to kind of talk to some other people, talk to detectives, and he figures out that Caca's real name is Nykerian Nealon, a 17-year-old who lived in a nearby apartment complex with his mother.
Wait, can we talk about the detective's name for just a second? That's amazing.
Esteban Montenegro. I agree. That is the best name I've ever heard.
I want Detective Esteban Montenegro on my case.
I just want his name.
Yeah. Does he show up in like a crushed red velvet suit?
I imagine it's like Zorro, right? Yeah. He has like a little like mask and a cape.
Yeah, to keep his anonymity. Sorry, you can continue now.
I agree. It's a fantastic name. Well, Detective Montenegro recognized this name because it appeared in a police report made on the night of the shooting. At 11:48 that night, Neyland's girlfriend had called the police to report the sounds of gunfire half an hour or so before she made the call. Neyland's name was listed as a victim on that report because he was allegedly at the apartment when the shots were heard. Weird, huh? We'll get back to this a little later. So Detective Montenegro goes to talk to Neyland. Neyland was at home with his mother and another young male about Neyland's age. I'm going to try to protect the identities of some of these people in this case, so let's just call this person Q.
Okay. Keika's friend Q.
Yeah.
Got it.
Q lived with Neyland, and they were very close friends, so close that they actually considered each other brothers. Neyland's mother allowed the detectives to search the home, and what do you know, they found 7.62 caliber cartridges hidden in the closet of Neyland's bedroom. But Neyland says he has no knowledge of the shooting, and says he doesn't even know how to shoot a rifle. Well, Montenegro noticed that as he's speaking to Neyland and his mother and telling them that they seem to have some evidence that Neyland was involved in Ahmed's murder, Q starts looking a little nervous and even at one point breaks down and starts crying. That tips him off that Q knows something more about what happened that night.
Yeah, that's what we call a big tell.
Exactly. So he gets Q to agree to come in for an interview. In that interview, Q basically admits the entire story of what actually happened that night. He said that he and Neyland had been hanging out at Neyland's girlfriend's apartment when they heard gunshots outside. Neyland thought that someone was trying to shoot at them. So he called two of his friends, one of them being a man nicknamed Black. Black came to the apartment with his own handgun. They then, all four of them, ran to Neyland's nearby apartment, grabbed his AK-47, then went out looking for the people Neyland thought had tried to shoot at them.
If you just hear gunshots outside of an apartment, what makes you think that they're shooting at you, per se?
Well, further investigation into Neyland's background showed that Neyland had some connection or ties to gangs or gang violence, so that's how that part makes sense.
Oh, I gotcha.
Because I agree completely. Why would you ever do that? But it's something to do with some kind of gang situation going down. The specifics of which I don't know, because that part was actually not allowed into the trial.
Okay.
His previous gang affiliation.
So he's thinking something's going down. There might be a drive-by or something where they're trying to target them. And they're going to go and get retribution and try and catch these people.
That's the story.
Painted in those terms, that kind of makes sense.
It's still crazy, but it makes sense. So Q says they were walking through Walnut Bend apartment complex trying to find the shooter when they spotted Ahmed, his wife, and his brother-in-law on the other side of the parking lot. Without saying anything, Q said that Neyland stopped, pulled out the rifle, and handed his phone to Black. When he saw Neyland ready his gun, Q turned to run and heard the gunfire erupt behind him. He said the gunfire lasted for about 15 seconds, and when it was over, he stopped and looked around for his friends. He turned to see Neyland still holding the rifle, and Black was still holding Neyland's phone and the handgun. They then started running, and Q and the other man there that night followed after those two, Neyland and Black. Q said that Neyland gave the rifle to someone shortly after the shooting, but he didn't know who. And that's an important part because this rifle was actually never recovered.
Oh.
Later, they ended up going back to Neyland's girlfriend's apartment, which is when they made the 911 call about the previous shooting they heard earlier that night. It's a little convoluted, but hopefully that's clear.
Yeah. So that's why they were on the victim sheet when the call was made.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Well, with Q's statements, the surveillance footage and the similar ammunition found in Neyland's bedroom, they were able to arrest Nigerian Neyland for the murder of Ahmed Al-Jumaili. When questioned again after his arrest, Neyland changes his story. He says, okay, I was lying the first time I talked to you. I just didn't want to get myself or my friends in trouble. He says what really happened was he was out there that night of the shooting, along with his three friends. He admitted to bringing his AK-47 along with him. He admitted to intending to shoot it. But he said that he raised the AK, meaning to shoot it straight up into the air, but that he couldn't get the rifle to work. It jammed or something. He said that then his friend Black, who was carrying the handgun, took the rifle from him, saying, "I'll show you how it's done." Black then proceeded to shoot at the vehicles in the parking lot. As they fled the scene, Nealon took the rifle back from Black, which is how he explains why he's seen in the footage carrying the rifle. Because that first individual that we see on that security footage is Nykerion Nealon holding a rifle. So basically, he's like, yeah, I was there, and I know what happened, but I was not the one to shoot.
Seems convenient. Seems like a nice story.
Yeah, I mean, but let's think about this. That story is hard to believe in light of what Q said happened that night, right? Because if you see someone raise a gun, turn away from them, hear gunfire, turn back to see that person still holding that gun, it's pretty logical to reason that that's the person who shot the gun, right? And that's what he said happened. He might not have actually seen Nykerion Nealon shooting the gun, but he saw him immediately before and immediately after.
And I think a key point in Q's statement there is that Black was still holding the phone
and the
pistol.
Yes.
And that means he hadn't given the phone back to him.
Yes.
So there was no way for them to exchange.
This exchange of weapons in Q's testimony did not occur, because it would have had to occur within like half a second.
And yeah.
I mean, that's illogical. It's an AK-47. It's a pretty hefty gun. You know, it couldn't have happened. I mean, I can't see how it could have happened within the second or so it took for him to turn away, turn back.
No, because he'd have to hand him the rifle, take his phone, and then they'd have to swap and then swap back before Q turned around to see what he saw. It makes no sense.
But essentially, that's what Nealon is saying. The other part of these kind of statements that are butting heads with each other is Q, again, is Nealon's best friend. And Q is saying, this is what I saw happened. He has no allegiance to Black. He actually didn't know Black at all. Black was Nealon's friend.
Really, he could have easily thrown him under the bus.
Yes, it really seems that Q is telling the truth as to what he witnessed that night. Nealon also said that he had no idea that anyone had been shot, and that he didn't learn of the death of Ahmed Al-Jumaili until someone messaged him later with the news story. So learning of this, Detective Montenegro was able to get a search warrant for Nealon's phone. He was hoping that there was some additional evidence there about what happened that night. After all, this is four teenage boys involved in a shooting where a man is killed, and they're likely to talk to each other, and they're most likely to do that over the phone, over text, over messaging, whatever. So that's kind of the basis of the search warrant. But when they get the phone, they see that it has been reset and all of the contents have been deleted. So, but of course, you can't really delete anything, can you?
Oh.
Yeah, they were able to, of course, extract all of the information that had been deleted from the phone. Well, after the night of the shooting, Nealon's phone had been used to search for some pretty interesting stuff, including how to kill someone without getting caught, how to commit the perfect crime, how to survive in prison, and finally, how to reset a phone so all data is deleted. Yeah.
Okay, that looks really bad.
Looks pretty bad.
And also, from the success of technicians that do this kind of work, digital forensic technicians, I'm imagining in the future, that's going to be like whole forensic science departments.
Oh, well, it definitely already is.
It already is. Yeah. But like, I can see it being such a bigger focus as we push towards the use of so much technology.
And what's interesting, too, is according to the court documents I read, that was done by the Secret Service.
Oh.
That's who actually did the recovery of the data in this case.
I know you can make requests to like the FBI.
So I guess that's how it went down.
Wow.
Kind of weird, though. Yeah. Well, after Nealon's arrest, the Dallas Police Department announced that Ahmed's death was not, in fact, a hate crime and that Ahmed had not been targeted for his faith or ethnicity. At a news conference, Major Jeff Kottner told media, quote, "We don't believe that he knew Mr. Al-Jumaili's ethnicity." So now it's kind of coming out that most likely this was not actually a targeted hate crime. Nealon's trial for the murder of Ahmed Al-Jumaili began in May of 2016. Q testified against Nealon at trial, recounting the story as I previously mentioned. He is clear in his testimony that he didn't hear Nealon say anything before opening fire. So this was just sort of a sudden, he didn't say, I'm going to kill these guys, or these are the guys who shot. He didn't say anything, which is very bizarre.
How weird.
Yeah.
So even for his best friend, this was out of the blue.
They knew that they were trying to find these shooters. I mean, as far as I know.
But he didn't expect them to just start opening fire.
No. And in fact, like, that's part of his testimony is when he saw him raise the rifle, he started running. Because he got scared and he started running the hell away.
Well, good on him for coming clean with all this and going on the stand.
Yeah, it was probably not easy, I'm sure. He also testified that he didn't actually see Nealon fire the rifle, but saw him with the rifle immediately after the shooting, as we were already talking about. Q also testified that the night after the shooting, Nealon told him to, quote, be cool and not tell anyone what had happened. Later, Q learned that someone had died in the shooting. And when Q asked Nealon about it, he had said that Nealon said simply, yeah, I've seen it. So pretty cold.
Yeah, be cool about just this murder that I forced you to be involved with.
Yeah, exactly.
Be cool about that.
Yeah. An officer also testified that if anyone had been inside either one of those vehicles that were shot out that day, that's the truck that Ahmed and his brother-in-law had ducked behind, and the vehicle right next to it, anybody in those vehicles would have also been shot, injured, possibly killed, because they were riddled with bullets. So basically, this shooting could have injured or killed multiple people, and that's including Zahra and her brother.
Yeah. And, you know, cars don't stop bullets like they do in the movies.
Yeah. So, and this is anyone else in this area. This is a high traffic apartment complex in a Dallas neighborhood. And let's also remember what is behind the line of vehicles and the group of people.
Apartments,
the
right?
The actual apartment complex, yeah. Which is an inhabited building.
We've heard many stories about ricochets and stuff like that, killing people.
Yeah. So this whole thing went down with absolutely no regard for human life. And it's lucky that more people didn't get hurt or killed. And that was basically this officer's testimony to that effect. Well, Nealon's defense really centered around this idea of, I didn't shoot the gun, and no one can prove that I did. Nealon testified in his own defense. He basically repeated the same story that he brought the rifle with him that night intending to fire it into the air, but that it wouldn't work. Black took it from him, handed him the handgun he'd been carrying, and started firing the AK at the vehicles. The exchange of the guns from his earlier statement went a little bit differently in his testimony. He testified that as they were running away, he dropped the handgun. So that's the handgun he had been holding while Black was shooting the rifle. So he dropped the handgun and then stopped to go back for it. Black handed him the rifle and said he'd go back for the handgun himself. So that's how the second exchange happens. And that's why, again, trying to explain away how he's seen in the security footage with the rifle.
But it's a little convoluted.
It's a little out there. He also admitted that while he had owned an AK-47, he had sold it to someone before the shooting, and that the AK-47 used in the crime was not his. He claimed that the rifle was actually one Black had stolen from someone else. So this was Black's rifle, Black's handgun, Black did the shooting. You know, he's blaming basically everything on Black.
This is like a ball and cup game of like, where's the rifle? Who owns the rifle? Who used it? Who shot it? What? I saw it and you had it. It's so confusing.
Exactly. The defense tried to argue that there's no forensic evidence that Nealon was the one to pull the trigger, which was true, that no witness can positively identify him as the shooter, as the one actually pulling the trigger when the shooting occurred, which was also true. And, you know, they pointed out that even Q's testimony didn't clearly point to him pulling the trigger, and nobody can prove that he did. The jury deliberated for 2 hours before finding Nealon guilty of felony murder on May 26, 2016, just over 1 year after the shooting. He was sentenced to 38 years in prison. He will be released on March 12, 2053.
Well, good for the jury that they didn't get caught up in the shell game of who had the AK win.
Yeah, exactly. But there is one bit of the puzzle that I will mention as an aside, and I'll let you all decide how much of an impact this information has in your opinion on this case. During Black's interrogation, detectives told him that Nealon had blamed him for the shooting. Black then blurted out something to the effect of, I can't believe he snitched on me. Now, Black was never asked to testify in the trial, so this was never allowed in as evidence. But later during his appeals, Nealon's team would try to suggest that this could have helped their defense because it suggested that Black was admitting to pulling the trigger himself. Yeah, okay. I mean, I can see where they're going with that. Personally, I don't think it could mean that at all. It really depends on the context in which it was said, and a lot of other things could have meant absolutely nothing at all. It would have been like, I can't believe he's blaming this whole scenario on me. But anyways, that's one part of Nealon's appeals that he was trying to say that evidence should have been allowed in. It could have helped his defense. So again, I'll leave that up to you as to whether or not that's something that kind of changes your mind or not. After the arrest and after the trial, the Center for American Islamic Relations thanked investigators, media, and the Dallas community for all of the support in solving this case. And their fundraising campaign for the Alti and Al-Jumaili families that Ahmed left behind, they ended up raising $35,000. So this is $35,000 that went directly to Zahra and her family.
That's amazing.
Exactly. It's just absolutely amazing the amount of support that came in. This was from 652 people from 13 different nations. So just a really outpouring of love and support.
Very cool.
The campaign website reads in part, quote, "In times of great sorrow such as these, it brings great comfort to know that good people all over the world send their love and support in memory of this beautiful life lost," which I thought was a very nice thing to say. And so that's the story of the murder of Ahmed Al-Jumaili. It's a tragic waste. This was a man fleeing violence only to become a victim of violence and random nonsensical violence at that. He left behind an adoring wife who was absolutely devastated by his loss. You know, I've seen footage of her. I saw part of her testimony. She's just, I mean, devastated. There's no better word to use. He had a whole family here in the United States, his family back home in Iraq, all just broken from this. And then the impact on the community, especially the Muslim population in Dallas, who feared there was some crazed gunman targeting Muslims in the area. And all because of a kid. And let's remember, Nealon was 17 at the time of the shooting. So he was a kid who wanted to play at being in a gang. And he ended up destroying his own life as well for no reason whatsoever.
And that was it? That was his whole reason for doing all this? Wow.
That was it.
Well, I mean, I guess thankfully it's not a hate crime and there's not a secret group of people roaming the streets trying to kill Muslims.
But I also think that's interesting. That, at the end of the day, there's that realization that more than likely this wasn't a targeted hate crime, but the publicity and the media attention and community support that was rallied around that initial fear might have actually been a part of the reason why this case was solved.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it could have been just another unsolved death in a neighborhood with a relatively high crime rate.
You mentioned, you know, before that that was a huge support for them. And how many crimes of immigrants and refugees do go unsolved?
That's a good question. You know, all of this goes to show that how important it is to pay attention to crime stories in your area, especially the small ones that aren't getting a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. Share them, talk about them, keep your eyes open, because these things directly impact the closing of cases and the solving of crime.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, how
very sad.
I can't believe they fled from like the approaching lines of ISIS.
Yeah.
And he probably saw tons of horrible things while he was there just to be here a month and get shot on the first snowing night.
And they were like the most adorable couple. They were just the cutest thing. It's just a tragedy. It's very sad.
Well, stay cool in jail. Kaycock or whatever your name is.
Kaycock.
I don't know. Well, man, that was a real downer of a story there.
Sorry.
But I think it's important, though. You brought up a lot of really good, interesting points. You ready to put this one to bed? Move on to something else?
I think so.
Maybe something that will make us remember the good times before tragedy struck.
Okay.
Maybe some good news?
That sounds lovely.
All right. We'll be back right after this. Okay, everybody, welcome back to the show. This is part of our after show. We're getting into our segment we like to refer to as good news. And this week, we go back to one of our favorite cities, Houston. And this is a nice tie-in for one of our later segments. But for now, let's talk about where this comes from. We had an awesome fan. We asked for good news suggestions, and you guys have been sending some in. And this one is from a listener named Shannon. It comes from clicktohouston.com. Basically, there's a doctor who has been really celebrated lately, who is at the end of his career for delivering babies. He's an OBGYN, and they did a really cool celebration for him at Children's Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston. Do you know why they've celebrated this particular day, Aaron? Like, if you're an OBGYN and you've hit like a milestone in your career, what would you think it would be?
It would be X number of babies, I would assume.
Yeah. Would 9,000 babies delivered shock you in a career?
That's a lot.
Yeah, man.
A lot of damn babies.
Seriously, it's pretty phenomenal. Over his career, Dr. Hector De Castillo Jr. delivered his final baby on September 7th. He's been working as a gynecologist and an OBGYN, but he's no longer going to deliver babies anymore. So this was kind of his last hurrah, his final baby that he got to deliver. And so after a long shift, after delivering his 9,000th baby, he comes out of the delivery room, still in all of his getup from just delivering babies.
Oh, just still like covered
in... No, he's clean. Like, he's okay. Washed up, but he's still in his smocks.
I just imagine it being a very messy process. I know nothing about it personally.
Yeah. Well, he comes out and he's got his hairnet on and everything. And the whole hallway is just full of employees that are cheering for him and clapping and celebrating. They had somebody there taking video of it. And he actually starts dancing and he's getting into it. And it's actually really cute because he's like an older doctor, you know, and he doesn't look like somebody who can bust a move, but he totally does. You got to go check out the video when we link it. As far as his work, Dr. Hector De Castillo Jr. said, quote, "It's the best job you can have. I can honestly tell you that I've never felt like I was having to work a day in my life. There isn't anything better that you can be doing as a doctor other than bringing fresh life into the world and making sure everyone's healthy."
There you go.
Dr. Castillo also said that the most babies he ever delivered in a single day was 18.
How?
That's a lot of babies to deliver in one
day.
That's
too many babies. Is he just there as they pop out and then he leaves the room after? I mean, what?
He's just
the
catcher.
How does that even make sense?
He's just receiving and then just hands them off to the next person. He also was talking about how it's a rewarding job, but, you know, a lot of people don't think about these doctors and the kind of long hours and weird shifts that you have to work when delivering babies, because you could be on call and just get called in the middle of the night pretty frequently to go down to the hospital and deliver a baby. He said that part of it was tough, but he never was upset when going into work. He was always looking forward to it. It always got him excited and amped up and wanting to do a good job because it's obviously very important. So, yeah. And it was a great day for him, a great day for the hospital, and it's a really cute, funny video, and you should go check it out. There you go.
Cool. Well, maybe I'm in the wrong line of work.
Why is that?
Maybe I should, I mean, if it sounds really good, this guy has sold me on it. Maybe I should go into baby delivery.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's like probably like a 3-month course, right?
Sure. Yeah, just a, like a part-time weekend course. Mm-hmm. You do a couple of mini-mesters.
I think I'd be great at it. I'm really good with babies.
Oh, man. If you ever have a baby, I can't be in the room. I'll lose it. I'll faint.
It's okay, because I won't remember, because I will be drugged up. This week, our podcast recommendation is going to be formatted a little bit differently. You're going to get an interview with our recommendation of the week. And this is our friends, B and Cece, down in Houston, Texas, and their wonderful podcast, Murder City.
Yeah, it's all about Houston and the Houston Metroplex, the surrounding area. It's one of the biggest cities in the country. Duh. There's a lot of real estate to cover. So their hands are definitely busy with their podcast. They've got a lot of material to cover. But what I like about their show is they're very personable. Both of the hosts are natives of Houston. And when they tell you about these different crimes, a lot of times they'll go and drive to the scene, like where it happened. They'll know the area. They just give a real nice personal Houston touch. And they make you learn a lot about Houston and the history and the culture of this particular Texas town that is unique. And they're going to tell you more about it in our interview, so I won't talk any more about their show. I'll let them talk about their show right here. What we have going for you guys is a exclusive awesome interview with one of my favorite podcasts, Murder City. And if you haven't heard about Murder City, you totally should. So let's introduce them really quick. Let me hear you. B and Cece, introduce yourselves.
Hello.
Hi, I'm B.
I'm Cece.
All right. And what's going on with you guys' show?
Everything. Oh my goodness. We're planning for an event in October. We're planning for an event in November. We're going to just try to keep it rolling.
Before we get into all the events, let's talk about what is your show, who you guys are, maybe like how you came together, and what you got you guys going. I'm always interested in those kinds of questions because it's a unique thing being a podcaster and how you end up forming it, you know?
Sure. So obviously we're based in Houston, Texas. Our whole podcast is Houston Crime all the time. We just met in April.
How did you meet each other and decide to just do Houston specific true crime?
We met at Domecoming, right? And we basically met by chance through Twitter. So the Houston Astrodome is known as the eighth wonder of the world. So before they started all the renovations for what the plan is for the dome is to become, they let everybody do kind of a walkthrough and kind of had a party basically raw before they did the construction on the Astrodome.
And you guys were there for that.
Right.
So our love for this city is why we made this podcast Houston-centered, because we met at something Houston-centered.
And by then, I had already made like social media and everything for the show, planning to do it solo. And I get a DM in my inbox, and she's like, I don't know what this is or who you are, but I want in. And I slept on it. I took like a day because this crazy person inboxed me with like volunteer work. And then I finally was like, something told me, you know what?
I'll give you my transcripts, yo. I will give you my firstborn child. I will prove to you. Look at my library and my Google search history.
Yeah.
It's like, let me go ahead and see what she's about. And that's what happened.
About when we met is the first time we met is actually recorded. Like nobody knew this at the time, but the first time we met and hung out is that Glenmont trip that shows up in episode one.
Oh, cool. That's the first time you guys met.
I took her immediately to a murder site.
Wow, that's brave.
Fun.
So you guys met together. You guys decided, hey, we hit it off. We're going to make a podcast. And when did you decide on the name?
Already had the name.
Well, okay. It was actually going to be a different name, but I asked one of the admins and one of the podcast groups for suggestions, and she steered me towards this one.
Oh, really?
And she's been supportive ever since. And you probably know who you are if you hear this, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
We love you.
Yeah, because I love your name. Like, once you hear you guys' name, you know exactly what your podcast is about and what you guys represent. And I don't think that you will be disappointed with what you get after you see the name point blank, you know, very CC in that way.
Yeah, we're very straightforward.
I wish I could take credit for the name, but I cannot. That is all B.
Oh, well, good job, B.
The original name was going to be Face City Slashers, and you can already tell how hard that is to say.
Oh, so. Yeah, that's a tongue twister.
Yeah.
If we have like a dodgeball team, can we name them the Space City Slashers?
I love that. What I love about your show is that you're one of the few Texas podcasts that's also a conversational podcast, which is what Aaron and I do, at least what we attempt to do. It's a hard thing to do, to have a conversational podcast that doesn't drift too much into banter, stays close to the facts, but is also kind of lighthearted, but also informative and emotional. So how do you guys deal with that?
We always have tried to be very straightforward. Even when we're contacting the families of victims and doing interviews and all of that, we immediately tell them, we're going to cover every detail that you give us. We feel like that's part of, I mean, it's 2018. The internet is doing well, and so is crowdsourcing, I feel like. The more information that you're able to give the people of your community, the better off it'll be in the long run.
Definitely. And there's a lot of people who are getting that kind of information from podcasts now. You know, there's millions and millions of listeners out there who are looking for shows like you guys and like ours. And if we can affect enough people and get them to volunteer for a search or something involving a unsolved crime or a missing person, then we've succeeded. you know?
Like, even discussion on the cases is great. I mean, as long as it doesn't get into, like, crazy speculation, conspiracy stuff, I feel like just having a conversation about what's going on will just heighten people's awareness of what's going on around them.
Definitely. Yeah, it'll get the word out.
Us and the city of Houston have a saying that if you see something, say something. And I think that that's just part of the point of why we have a podcast, is that don't think that it can't happen around you or near you or to somebody you know, because if you make it personal to somebody, they're more likely to remember something. They're more likely to notice something more relatable to them.
For sure. So you guys, you've mentioned you're kind of babies to the podcasting world. Your show kind of dropped recently this past spring. But have you guys already developed a favorite episode or a case that has been particularly close to your heart that you've gotten to cover, or maybe that you have on the back burner?
Answers to all of those questions. A favorite episode? I don't think I have like a favorite. They're all my children.
Right? Yeah, I get that.
As far as favorite case, like pet case that we featured, would be definitely be episode 2. That was with Robert Spangenberger
and Joanne Huffman.
Yes. That was the case back in 1979 that's still unsolved. And we're actually still working with both families this day, trying to get in with the cold case detectives and get their case like moving again. And as far as cases on the back burner, I have so many. It's sad.
Like when we came together, what's kind of, I don't know if it's weird, but we both as individuals had kind of cases that we were working up on our own. And we put together a spreadsheet of all of our cases. And there was surprisingly very little overlap. For whatever reasons, we like different cases. And well, so great. We put them all together and we compiled this list, which is kind of where we get our cases from. And at this point, we're at 76, and I know that both of us are behind in adding to it.
Yeah.
You guys are Murder City for a reason. Down here.
I was telling Cece, I think I even said it in Austin, like, we could probably put out a Murder City, you know, 1979. Daily. Murder City, 1978. Like, every year could have its own set of episodes. So, like, it's ridiculous.
Do you guys have any plans on any big cases that you kind of want to drop some hints on? Or if you don't want to, that's okay too.
I will.
Just a hint. Ooh. You can't say what it is.
In the works, that's coming out the end of September.
We have a meeting for this Saturday. I'm super excited.
Yeah, we have a meeting set up for this one this Saturday. And like you said, B kind of runs the show and I kind of provide some humor, but I do provide cases every now and again. Yeah. Mine just don't have pretty little bows on them. Mine are kind of a mess. It's a pretty package with a very ugly bow on top. That's the best way I can put it. Okay. It's out of Houston.
It is a very highly requested case. Since
we've
opened this, and this will probably be the first case that we've done that has been, because we get requests, I mean, you can imagine, for Dean Corll, for like all, you know.
This one kind of takes a native Houstonian of a certain age to know about. I think that's all I'm going to give on that, honestly. I don't know that if I give anything else away, people are going to know what it is.
Perfect. I love the mystery. I love like the subtle hinting. So it'll leave some fans interested. Yeah. Well, let's talk about like some of the Houston-centric things that you guys have going on. First of all, I have to say, I love how involved with the community and how much of a spotlight you guys put on Houstonians and things that are going on in Houston with all of your episodes. I really appreciate that. Everything you guys went through with Hurricane Harvey, ongoing missing persons cases.
I think it just goes to like our love for the city. I mean, we met at Dome Coming because without a doubt, there is nothing that we won't do for this city, basically. I mean, nothing but great things to say about this city, but that doesn't mean that we're not afraid to go to the dark places that this city has.
I think in the latest GQ article that came out, I'm sure you've seen it.
Oh, I heard about it in your last episode.
There's a line in there where they say something like, Houston is like that brother cousin that's been through some shit.
And Houston is the cool older brother. I would say the whole thing, but it would be offensive and they would have to edit it for content. Earlier in the article, they relate Austin, Dallas, and Houston as different brothers of the same family. And Houston is the older brother that's seen some things and knows what's cool and not. And I think that that's pretty apt.
Yeah.
We just kind of, we slow roll it, but, you know, we're progressive and we're also, look at what's dirty about this city.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you guys adopt that and that you welcome that and it puts you in the setting. But, you know, you talked about it in one of your recent episodes, how you've thought about getting styrofoam cups with you guys' logo on it, just because that's such a Houston thing.
We're thing. This sounds weird, but we're not being fake about it at all. I think
we're not putting on or anything. This is just to us. Like, honest to God, we are this, like, of Houston. And that's what's beautiful about the city is that it's not white or black or anything else. It is literally a rainbow of everybody. And we kind of, you know, being born and raised here, we have just adopted all of that.
Another article I read, and I'm sorry for all the lame Houston quotes. Houston is not a melting pot. We're a salad. Like a house salad,
right,
where you can see every part that's in the salad and you know what you're eating. But when you put it all together, it's delicious and it goes down really well. And I think that description of this town.
Harvey happened, everybody kind of saw, you know, everybody was amazed at Houston. They were like, oh, look, black and whites and cats and dogs and everybody working together to save each other in the hurricane. And we all kind of looked at each other and we're like, yo, this is a Thursday. Like, this is what we do every day. I don't know why this is so surprising. Well, because our entire goal is to be able to give back to our community. And part of giving back is, you know, we recently raised money for Texas EquiSearch, which needed money badly. They still need money because they provide full service for only donations. They're a nonprofit.
We've actually been to Missing in Harris County Day, where we met some of the volunteers there. And then we went to Allie Lowitzer's fundraiser even more there. And they are the most welcome bunch.
They're a very small organization, but they are so good and so invested in what they do that they don't necessarily, like, they don't have social media, right? Like, that's how busy Tim Miller is. Unfortunately. And personally, I want to make a point to say that Tim Miller doesn't know what happened to his daughter. Technically, still, he has no idea. Her name is Laura Miller, and she was found in part of the Texas killing fields off of Calder Road. And Texas EquiSearch was started because he knows what it's like to wait around for a year with no help from anybody, wondering what happens to your child when they go missing. Yeah. And he still has no, for lack of a better term, closure as to what actually happened to Laura. But he still goes around and helps all of these families find some sort of answers.
Yeah. Well, again, I thank you guys for being involved. And we were so happy that so many people jumped forward and wanted to help. Appreciate you guys so much. Like, that, my heart goes out to you guys.
Oh, we appreciate everybody pitching together for something. I mean, we're the true crime community, literally. I mean, there's nothing more important than search and rescue. So
yeah, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've reached the end of our interview. We've talked about a lot, but tell everybody any last thoughts that you have and anything that you want people to know about your show and what's going on with you guys, where they can find you. Go for it.
I was just going to plug the event. I was going to say we have two events coming up.
Well, before she does the event, I do want to mention real quick, since you guys are like huge, like we said, we're working with Maria Rodriguez's sister, Gloria. Maria went missing on June 21st of this year. And I mean, literally a hole opened up in the earth and she was swallowed in. And there's been nothing.
Like, she literally got in her truck and drove to the office. We did a mini episode on this. Working with Gloria, we are still in touch with Gloria. And I guess we're pleading at this point.
Yeah, I just, since y'all are more known, I just wanted on your show to, if you see Maria, please, please, please
call. If you saw her that morning.
Anything. We just need something.
You can get at us if you have any tips, anything like that, any ideas for shows, any feedback. We're always willing to listen. You can find us at murdercitypod.com. You can email B at murdercitypod@gmail.com. I am CC at murdercitypod.com. On Twitter, you are
murdercitypod.
I am murdercitypodcc.
If you're in the Houston area and you need assistance or someone to shine a light on a certain case, we are more than happy to be the one.
And if you happen to be in the Houston area coming up in the next few months, we're hosting a meet and greet with all of the fantastic residents at the Glenwood Cemetery in the afternoon. And then November 17th, we are hosting another meet and greet social for us and...
It's H-Town Podfest 2018. And I would go through the list of podcasts again, but it's literally over a dozen shows coming.
And we want more. Come hang out with us November 17th at Boheme Bar. From 7 to 1.
Add yourself onto our Facebook group, Houston, Texas True Crime. We have all the details for it there.
And you get insider information.
Yes, you get extra clips. We put extra pictures in our group.
We talk theories.
We share all sorts of neighborhood, creepy, peeping Tom type things going on. So
it's just the group you want to belong to.
Well, thank you guys for being on the show. I appreciate finally getting to meet you guys and talk to you and do an interview. And I hope we can make it out to one of those events this fall. I'm really hoping we can do that. If anything else, let's collaborate in the future. Let's do some more fundraisers and maybe do a crossover episode in the future.
Sounds good to us.
All right. Well, with that, thank you guys for being on and appreciate your help and your service to everything you do for the greater Houston area true crime community.
It's hold it down.
Do your thing. Keep being awesome. I'm so glad to be involved with you guys.
Thank you for everything. We appreciate everything.
Much love from the Dirty Third.
Excellent. Love it. All right, guys. Have a good episode.
Have a good night. Tell Aaron we say hi.
Okay, I will.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed that interview with our friends at Murder City. Definitely go check them out.
Murder City!
And for now, it is now time for a five-star review.
Yeah!
And as we mentioned earlier in the show, we have a new Patreon. I hope you guys check it out. We worked really hard on developing tiers that we think you guys would enjoy. We're really looking forward to getting more interaction with you guys. And I hope you guys will really like it. We're really excited about it. And because of that, we are now going to be transitioning to reading off the Patreon member names at the end of the show. So we're no longer going to be reading five-star reviews, but we're going to give you a little bit of time in case you do want to have your name read, but for whatever reason, you don't want to support us on Patreon. That's cool. You do your thing. Because if you have a five-star review that's posted before September 18th, so that's 1 week from when this episode comes out, you will be fine and we will still read all of those reviews. Anything after September 18th is, you're just out of luck.
Yeah. Continue to rate, review us on iTunes and Facebook and send us your awesome cow jokes or llama jokes per se. And we'll take those. And if we find a really awesome one, we might just still read it.
Yeah, we might just do that. So remember, that's either iTunes or Facebook. Any five-star reviews there, we will get you going. And I don't know why I said it like that. And we also wanted to plug our social media. We are on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. We are on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. And you can send us an email at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. I am very, very behind you guys on responding to you. But I do promise if you've emailed us that we have read it. It's just I have to sit down and spend probably several hours one day responding to everybody.
That's the problem with a successful podcast. You end up with a lot of people wanting to talk to you.
Are we successful?
I mean, yeah.
We do okay. I don't know.
Yeah, and we also had, speaking of great listeners, we have this really cool listener, Angela, who has a side business doing laser etching on glassware and different things that are made of glass. She can even do like nameplates that are made of glass. And I really want some nameplates for meetups so people know who we are, because it's kind of weird when you show up and people are like, who are you? Mm-hmm. What show are you from?
What name are you going to get emblazoned on it? Is it going to be Dork Novinsky?
I think I'm going to go Shea Butter. That's what the ladies like.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with that. But she made us some really neat glasses with our logo on it. One of them's a wine glass that's like of a large size, which, hey, she knew us. We need them large wine glasses. And then we got a like tall boy, long neck Pilsner glass with our logo on it. And both of them are really sweet. Yeah. So I'll make sure to tag her Facebook page where you can find out all about their business. It's booming. They've gotten really busy and they do a really good job. But yeah, they're at Hoke Walker Originals on Facebook. So that's spelled HOUKWALKER Originals. There you go. Thank you, Angela. We will be imbibing with these while we do the show.
Yes, it was a perfect present. So we do appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And we love when fans send us stuff.
And if you have anything that you'd like to send to us, don't make it weird, but you can send it to All Crime, No Cattle, P.O. Box 11611, Fort Worth, Texas, 76011.
Send us your weird stuff.
Our first reviews today come from iTunes. The first one being from VBL. In what? VBLVNV. That's what it is. And they say, one of the best. While finding new podcasts in true crime, this one was high on the list of the best.
Oh, it was. We're high.
Whose list?
We're high. Hey, it's of the best. That's the list right there.
I like it.
The world's list.
I doubt that. Thank you, VBLVNV.
Yeah, you're great.
Appreciate it.
You're high on our list.
The next one is Angelie P, who says, great. I'm a newcomer to your podcast, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. You guys have great chemistry, duh, you're married, and do a wonderful job relaying the information.
Yeah, I mean, and as long as I'm the current husband, I think our relationship's going okay. It's when I'm the former, then it's clearly fallen apart.
Then we might have to reconsider this podcast.
Yeah.
But for now, everything's fine. Next one is from Kayla1008. And they said, can't stop, won't stop. I'm obsessed with your podcast. I live in Fort Worth, and listening to these episodes about true crime so close to home just blows my mind. I started listening today, and I will probably be caught up by the time I leave at work at 5. Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope you still enjoy it.
I love that she can't stop, won't stop, can't stop, won't stop.
Is that from something?
No, I don't know. I'm going with it. It's from me.
There you go, Kayla. That's your little song. And next up is Nol11, N-O-L-1-1, and they say, my opinion. I enjoy this podcast. The quality is very good and the hosts have a casual tone instead of a dead serious one, which is nice. I like how the co-hosts are a married couple, which is something I've never seen in a podcast before. They're also able to get a few light jokes in here and there, which I personally enjoy. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to read my opinion. Have a nice day, y'all. Oh, that's such a sweet, it's been very wholesome.
Yeah, I like that review. And it also like paints a picture of what we try to do on this show. So
yeah,
appreciate it. That means we're doing a good job.
Thank you. And the last one from iTunes comes from Miss KHawk87. And they say, love it. I super enjoy this podcast. I'm honestly not even sure how I stumbled across it, but I'm sure glad I did. I love how well put together this podcast is. Oh, and I really enjoy the good news at the end of the show. Ooh, hey, want to hear a knock-knock joke? Of course you do. Knock-knock, who's there?
I don't know.
Cow says, smell mop.
Smell mop poo. Oh, man.
You ruined the joke. You're supposed to say, what is the answer?
Well, you say the same thing, and then you say who. And that's when I started to say it, and then I realized it was poo.
Yeah. But, you know, just reading it, it doesn't work because it took me a minute to understand. I was like, smell mop who? What are you talking about, Miss KHawk87?
I think that's the reaction that joke is engineered to get, though.
Right? Probably.
Like, it smells like up dog in here. And then the person's supposed to be like, what's up, dog? And you're like, what's up, dog? I don't know. What's up with you?
Thank you, Miss KHawk87. We appreciate a good cow joke.
Moving on to Facebook 5-star reviews. First one comes from Lisa Kilpatrick Connerly. That sounds like a good Irish name. I salute you. I love this podcast. Great cases and great research. I'm from Texas, and some of these cases I know and some I don't. Even though I know some of the cases, sometimes you don't get all the facts, and Aaron and Shay give me that. Can't wait for more each week. Well, thank you, Lisa. We can't wait for you to listen.
Thank you, Lisa.
Shereen Nicole says, just found your podcast today and I'm already hooked. Love that it's Texas. I'm pretty familiar with the places you're talking about too, so that's great. Well, thank you, Sheree. Glad you're familiar with it and that you're enjoying it. Jeffrey George says, absolutely a great podcast. Just finished binging all your episodes. Love them.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Hopefully you will continue to enjoy them. Yeah. I'm always so worried somebody's going to come back and be like, I overshot the goodness of this podcast. Originally, it really deserves like 2 stars.
The first 4 episodes, which are probably our worst, those were the best. Everything else was terrible and I couldn't finish listening to it.
Yeah, you guys are garbage and go die.
Yeah. What you have to do is you have to take that mentality of that other review, which is can't stop, won't stop.
Can't stop, won't stop.
Tom George says, I've listened to several episodes and I really like this podcast. I'm not a huge true crime fan, so I think ACNC is just the right dose of true crime for me. If you live in Texas, give it a listen.
Oh, very good. Yeah, thank you.
A non-true crime listener likes us. That's weird because we are super true crime.
Yeah.
The Puppers. Have they had dinner?
They sure have.
The Puppers.
Oh, come on. Like they would be sitting there peacefully resting if they hadn't eaten their dinner. Well, these two act like they've never eaten before in their lives every day at about 8:45 p.m.
Which is 15 minutes before dinner time. They'll yes. start their begging. And their begging isn't that horrible. It mainly consists of them being affectionate and very lovey and putting their head on your leg.
A lot of like paw slaps. Yeah. Paw slap.
Hey.
Paw slap.
Hey.
Hey. Hey, remember me?
It's dinner time.
Need some food.
What time is it? What time is it? What time is it now? Is it dinner time yet?
They're very annoying. But we love them. Yeah. That is the show. Come back next week.
Yeah. Oh, and definitely go check out our Patreon, like Aaron said, with the tiers. We still have merch over at the Threadless Shop. Just search All Crime, No Cattle. We still want to see your Rose and Bones. Somebody recently picked up another meat cut shirt, so we got the meat cut design. Check that out. I like it. Other than that, I think we'll just have to catch up with you next week. Always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.